Welcome to the Norris Group's Real Estate Radio Show. Hosted by author, investor, hard money lender, and real estate educator, Bruce Norris. Equipping California real estate professionals for tomorrow's challenges.
Hi, thank you for joining us. My name is Bruce Norris. Today, our special guest is Tom Anderson. Tom is the vice chairman and founder of Pensco Trust Company and Pensco Inc. He is considered by many to be the national expert, author, and speaker on the topic of self-directed IRAs and plans. In addition, Tom focuses on how investors can increase their wealth building potential with real estate and private equity investments. He's written articles for nearly all the nation's financial magazines and was recently invited to Washington as part of the Future of Finance Initiative to assist the Obama administration as they create new rules for the lending world. Tom, welcome to our show.
Thank you, Bruce. It's a pleasure.
I'm just curious what those meetings in Washington were like.
Well, being in the business, banking business for 41 years and the self-directed investment business for about 22, the government is paying more and more attention to retirement issues, obviously because of the concern over Social Security, and there's more and more interest in trying to assist people in saving for retirement. Unfortunately, though, we're still pretty much in the dark ages as far as understanding within the government as to what the possibilities are, even under the current rules. So when you're talking to people, there seems to be new and startling information that you can do more than buy mutual funds with your retirement account, and that's one of the reasons that our industry, that is the self-directed industry, hasn't made more progress, because I'm sure you're aware many Americans are unhappy with being locked in through their 401k plan or other pension plan or even IRA into a small subset of investment, opportunities, namely those that are in Wall Street.
Okay.
And particularly with the downturn that we all experienced in our portfolios over the 2008 to 2010 time frame.
Yeah, there might have been some alternative choices.
Exactly. And, we did have a global recession for the first time in, recorded financial history, where all sectors essentially went down, with one exception, which is some commodities like gold, which are inversely coordinated to most of the markets. But only lately have people jumped on the gold bandwagon, and that's temporal. That's until everything else recovers, and it'll go in the opposite direction then. So it's now really a good long-term savings vehicle.
When you were in Washington, were your ideas listened to by somebody with comprehension on the subject, or was it really news to them?
Well, it was news, but they were very interested, which I found refreshing. It's been a long time for us in terms of the industry being able to get the attention of the government in terms of seeking, actually, our input and our participation. In fact, our association, which is called the Retirement Industry Trust Association, which essentially envelops about 90% of the self-directed custodians in the United States, was invited to write a white paper on our view of the need for more diversification in retirement accounts. And we are in the process of doing so. However, the recent election results has this basically changed the chairs on the Titanic, if you will, as to who we would be talking to, because the people we were talking to before are not in position anymore. But it seems, though, that in general, spoken recently to members of the IRS that are involved with IRAs, for example, and people in the Department of Labor who are involved with the termination of prohibited transactions, and members of the House and even the government administration, that there's much more receptivity to ideas on how to improve retirement savings. So as an association, and I'm as the president of the association, it's my goal to sort of grab the opportunity and to continue to be proactive in interfacing with the government on how we can assist them in improving savings situations for all Americans.
When did self-directed IRAs come about?
Well, believe it or not, IRAs were created in 1974 as part of ERISA, which is the Employee Recovery Investment Securities Act, I think. I don't know what exactly.
That's pretty close.
Pretty close. And actually, you could self-direct an IRA then. You could have purchased real estate in New Zealand in 1974 if you wanted to. People weren't aware of that because very quickly the securities industry, including the mutual fund companies, sort of locked up the market by lobbying to a large degree and sort of convincing the powers to be that things like real estate were not really prudent investments within pension plans and in addition IRAs. In fact, I think that's where the name alternative sprung up, because traditional has been attached to Wall Street investments and sort of a comfort nomenclature, but alternative has sort of a negative connotation to many people, alternative lifestyle, etc. But it's all marketing and it's all lobbying, and as you know, and as many Americans know, real estate is a very good long-term investment. And granted, we're in a major downturn, but this certainly has happened as well in the stock market and many times before. Real estate generally has outpaced the stock market on a long-term basis.
Well, you know, in my state, California, I mean, we can buy properties at cash flow for the first time in a long time. So
exactly. So when there is a downturn, it's really an opportunity for those that are not holding the assets that want to get into the market. It's an excellent opportunity for them to take advantage of and to ride the curve up as opposed to riding the curve down, like those of us who did own property back in 2006, 2007, or whatever.
Yeah. What had been the structure of the retirement vehicle before 1974?
Well, there were pension plans, but there were no IRAs. IRAs are
right.
Created that year.
So, okay, so pension plans for like a big company like a GMAC or...
Sure. In fact, one of the reasons IRAs were created was because of the abuse that was going on by the trustees or the employers regarding the employees' participatory amounts, whatever they had saved was being abused by trustees in the sense of buying a personal asset or yacht or whatever, or just making imprudent investments and losing the money, or just spending the money for their own personal purposes. And so ERISA was to try to correct some of those abuses, but at the same time, the government felt it was necessary to allow people to save on their own where they would be immune from somebody else manipulating their assets.
What does self-directed mean?
That's a good question. It's asked all the time. People think it's some chemical process that an IRA goes through to become self-directed. But it's basically, first of all, IRAs are IRAs, regardless of where they're held, whether they're at Merrill Lynch, Schwab, or PIMCO Trust. The rules are dictated by the IRS, and they're common for all IRAs. And the difference is that depending on where they're held, the custodian or the trustee will limit what an investor can do with their IRA. And if they don't allow you to make your own investments beyond a limited set, it's generally not considered self-directed. But if you are, there are two types of really self-directed. One is a self-directed brokerage account where, let's say, for example, Charles Schwab or Ameritrade, they'll allow you to pick any one of, thousands of stocks and mutual funds. But they won't allow you to buy real estate, for example, or in most cases, private equity. So while it's self-directed in the sense that you make the decision and you can sit at your computer at night and, buy 100 shares of IBM without any intervention on the part of the custodian, you are limited to a small set of options. And then the other type, which I'm a part of, which Rita represents, are the companies that allow you to invest anything that's permitted by law. And that goes way beyond the stock market. So, for example, you could buy a small company in Spain, the equity of that, or you could buy, as our clients, some of our clients have, a property in New Zealand. And when you buy property outside the country, you have two factors to consider. One is the exchange rate differences and how that fluctuates, and if it goes up in the sense that the foreign exchange exceeds the value or increases in terms of value against the U.S. dollar, then you make money not only potentially on appreciation but on the exchange rate. If it goes down, it can either offset your gain in appreciation, or it can, you know, add to a declining or depreciation on the asset. So you have to watch both of those elements in a foreign investment. But, you know, it potentially has a much greater yield, and it potentially has a much greater loss if they both combine.
Is there a level of sophistication required to invest in some categories?
Well, absolutely. I think, you know, what we try to communicate to people that come to us is that, you know, think about investing in what you know. If you're good at, you know, running gas stations and you work in a gas station, you might consider, you know, having your IRA buy a gas station.
I guess what I'm saying, are there laws in place that say, okay, you don't have enough experience to make that investment?
Well, yeah, there are, in the sense of the asset sponsor. The asset sponsors of private equity, for example, depending on how they structure their deal, and if they go out to beyond friends and family, where they're going to the general public, in which case they have to register either an exemption or a public offering, there are laws as to who they can deal with. And generally speaking, they can't take in more than 35 unaccredited investors or unsophisticated investors. And in some cases, they can't take in any unsophisticated investors. People have to be accredited, which means they have to have $1 million minimum net worth and at least $200,000 in income for the last couple of years. Although that may have changed recently, I understand that the SEC is considering changing the definition of accredited investors. My guess is it'll probably increase because over the last few years, a lot of people have not only lost money in the stock market, but they lost money in private equity as well.
Okay, so if somebody's willing to make an investment, it sounds like they kind of are looking out for themselves. There's not laws in place of saying, okay, well, you don't have a... I understand what you just said about accredited, but somebody wants to buy a trust deed or a rental unit or stuff. They're free to do that even if they only have 80 grand in an account as opposed to there's a minimum amount they have to have, that type of thing.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, there's two ways of looking at these kinds of things. You can say the glass is half empty or it's half full. And I like to think that IRAs are a great source of capital and capital formation in the United States, which they are, because we at Pensco, you know, we started out with no assets. We're now at $3.5 billion, and we have started, you know, effectively either entirely by funding or partially funding thousands of companies that wouldn't possibly be started without the use of IRA accounts because they couldn't get financing from traditional sources. And IRAs are there as a major capital source, about $4 trillion in IRA assets sitting on the sidelines to be allocated.
How much money are in IRAs? Just
about $4
trillion. $4 trillion. Oh, my gosh. Okay. I had no idea.
What I'm saying is that, you know, we've had people with – I'll give you one example. Now, this doesn't say how much this person had in net worth or how much they might have had in other IRA accounts elsewhere, but one person opened a $300 Roth IRA with us. And our minimum fee is $375 a year. So they had a plan here, and basically this person instructed us to send a $10 check overnight to Indianapolis to a lawyer to consummate a real estate option contract whereby they were given a right for 30 days to buy a property from a developer who needed some cash for $350,000. That contract was assignable, and while he was negotiating the contract, our IRA holder found a buyer for the same property for $525,000. So when he got the $10 check and the contract was signed, he assigned it over to this other buyer, took in the $525,000, paid the seller the $350,000, and then moved $175,000 into their IRA account with us.
Well, you said more specifically a Roth IRA, which is kind of beneficial.
Yes, actually tax-free growth for life. And that, by the way, represents a 2.6% annual net rate of return. If you divide $5,000 by 10 and multiply it by 365, that's what you get. But we have another example. of a person who started an internet company with $1,800 in a Roth IRA, and they were actually going to use a regular IRA, and I convinced them that this was in 1999, that this new Roth was a better vehicle because they had high hopes of developing a pretty successful venture. And ultimately they did. In June of 2002, that person cashed out with $32 million on his $1,800 investment. Then took that $32 million, used it to invest in other startups, and has increased his IRA holdings to the nine digits.
Now, it's just hard to imagine, and everything you're saying I know is exactly true. It's the IRS is looking at this going, okay, we got to change that. Or they're perfectly happy to leave it alone.
This person has created thousands of jobs,
okay,
all of which produce income that produce taxes. So while they aren't paying taxes because it's a Roth IRA, they've stimulated the economy. And without, even hearing about it on TV, 40% of new jobs are from startups, and 70% of new jobs are from small companies. So either secondary, non-public companies, either secondary rounds of financing that can happen either by loans or equity infusion from IRAs, all of these are necessary, to keep especially with the credit situation the way it is.
Now, there were some rule changes that took place in 2010 for a Roth conversion. So can we talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. In fact, we still have about 35 days to take advantage of a one-time window of opportunity. And beyond the fact that now your IRA is or your pension plan is now portable and can be directly converted to a Roth IRA, which it wasn't able to be done before this 2006 change, you now can convert a regular traditional IRA, or for that matter a pension plan, to a Roth IRA regardless of your income, whereas before this year, before January 1st, 2010, if you made more than $100,000, you were just prohibited outright from making doing a conversion from your traditional IRA to a Roth. And in addition to that, that particular provision being eliminated, and not only eliminated for 2010, but for the future as well, until it's changed again, you have a one-time window of opportunity to do the conversion this year and defer the taxation on the converted amount to the years tax years 2011 and 2012. And that is to say that in 2011, you'd have to claim 50% of the converted amount as income on your 2011 return if you convert in 2010, and the other 50% of the 2000 amount or the 2010 amount in 2012, which effectively moves it out to April 15th of 2012 and April 15th of 2013. So, if you are anticipating a hockey stick kind of investment where you can, really get a multiple of return, or if you are anticipating to be in a lower tax bracket in the future, or if you are a young person with a long timetable to have your IRA grow tax-free and get tax-free compounded growth, or if you want to leave your Roth IRA to your children and give them a tax-free vehicle for life, these are all reasons to consider doing this conversion, and the government is, really incenting these conversions. The main reason is they need the tax.
Right, they get to collect the tax up front.
Right, and so they're trying to push more into, it's one way to trigger taxable events, to push more things into Roth IRAs. But it is practically a really good opportunity. Another situation or scenario that makes it attractive is, let's assume you bought some assets in 2005 or up until 2008 before the downturn, and they've now depreciated, and you're holding them in your IRA account. While they're depreciated, if you do the conversion, you'll be paying tax at a lower amount and then allow them to recover inside the Roth, and that growth will be all tax-free. So it's much better to convert a depreciated asset than an appreciated asset.
Capital gains rules apply within the IRA?
No. capital gains rules do not apply within the IRA. Basically, when you take money out of an IRA, it's whatever you take out, whether it's all of it or part of it, is taxed at ordinary income rates. Unless it's a Roth IRA and it's been held for 5 years and you're at age 59 and a half, in which case you can take it all out tax-free.
Okay, but taking it out, does that ever make sense? If we just leave it in there and it produces income, you can take the income out and leave the principal in?
Well, you can, but at some point, if it's a traditional IRA at age 70 and a half, you have to start taking out what are called minimum distributions. And that's another reason to get the money into a Roth IRA, because you never have to take the money out of a Roth IRA. And even when you die, you can leave it to your children, and they don't have to take, well, they have to take it out over their expected lifetime, but there's no limit to the growth each year. So,
but it's not taxable to the estate then?
No.
That's a big deal.
Sorry, the tax has already been paid.
That's a very big deal.
Yeah, it's a big estate planning vehicle. Absolutely.
Okay. Only 3.5 minutes left in this segment. Okay, the use of leverage to accomplish purchases of real estate. Is that allowed?
Absolutely. In fact, this is another not well-known opportunity and strategy, and that is that it's possible to borrow money in virtually any state in the United States. You can borrow up to 70% from a bank, and there's a leader in this industry. It's called North American Savings Bank, which can be found at www.iralending.com. And they will lend up to 70% on most property types, exceptions of like land, for example, that doesn't generate income. But any income-producing asset virtually or property, they'll lend on. And the reason that it has to be at least a 30% down payment by the IRA is that these loans have to be done on a non-recourse basis. And that's because if they were recourse, that is, if you were to guarantee the loan for your IRA, you'd be doing something that's prohibited, which is called self-dealing, because you'd be personally guaranteeing an asset or debt for your IRA, and therefore you're self-dealing with your IRA.
The 70%, is that by bank policy, or is that by some statute that's in the rules?
No, it's entirely bank policy.
Okay.
And they've been pretty successful in this particular bank's case, having very few foreclosures even during this downturn, because they do, I mean, they're in the business of not only underwriting these loans, but they hold the loans. They keep them on their books. They don't sell them off, and therefore it's directly related to their, the loan results are directly related to their own profits.
Do you have any idea what the rates are for the loans?
I haven't looked recently, but generally they're like two points above the standard rates.
So seven-ish or something like that might be possible.
Yeah, yes, probably something like that.
That's a great rate.
It's on their website at iralending.com.
Okay.
These things I think are all negotiable too, depending on the deal. I mean, they're going to look for some cash reserves. They're going to look for, cash flow from a tenant. They're going to look for other assets you might be able to tap if you were in jeopardy. But believe it or not, there's actually a rule that allows you to bail out your IRA. Let's suppose you get this 70% loan. Let's say it's a $100,000 house and you put $30,000 down with your IRA. You've got a tenant, it's producing cash flow. The cash flow is sufficient to pay the mortgage from the bank. Everything's going along nicely, and all of a sudden you lose a tenant. And you can't replace the tenant, and, oh, by the way, you used all the cash that was available in your IRA, and now you can't make your mortgage payment, and you're potentially going to be foreclosed on. That is, your IRA would be foreclosed on, which would mean the IRA would lose the asset, the bank would take back the property. Well, you can actually, under a provision of the Department of Labor called 80-26, you can actually lend money to your own IRA to bail it out without a limit on the amount, provided that the amount is being used just to sustain the operation of the IRA and to, cover deficit for an operating loss like this.
Okay. Tom, we've reached the end of this show. We're going to pick this subject right up on our next segment. Tom Anderson has joined us from Pensco, and we'll pick this discussion up in the next segment.
You've been listening to the Norris Group Real Estate Radio Show. For more information on the Norris Group, please visit www.thenorrisgroup.com.